You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So Dave's last act with the boat was to... It's a long story, but put it this way, we ended up with a cargo of porcelain.
Okay.
And I got a share of it, and that was what gave me the capital to buy half the boat.
This is Martin Daly talking about how he financed the purchase of the Indies Trader.
So Dave Barnett, my mentor, was an absolute pirate, and he made his money, his initial money, by... taking all the scrap metal off the Second World War ships, mainly manganese bronze, the propellers and the condensers, because they were steamships, and they had these big, you know, lots of copper pipe in these condensers. And back in the 70s, late 60s, when he was doing it, copper was like $1,000 a ton scrap. And you could buy a house for $8,000.
Wow.
So he'd go out for 6 weeks and come back with 30 tons.
Whoa.
That's four houses. You know, it was a bonanza. And so this, well, the Indies Trader was built specifically to do that.
Okay.
To pick up scrap off diving, you know, salvage. And Dave was also interested in whatever else he could liberate from the ocean floor, as he used to put it. So he taught me a whole lot. But as it was to buy the boat off Dave, I didn't have enough money. And he wanted $100,000, which was a lot of money in 86. So I met another guy who was mad keen into treasure hunting, a rich guy. A guy called Frank Taylor, a bit of an aviation, sort of a larger-than-life legend dude. Frank, we went and did all his jobs in China and the Philippines, and we never really did that well. It looked like the salvage thing was going to be a business. All this new technology, GPS had just come out. Sonar technology just was really accelerating. ROVs were coming into the remotely operated vehicles, coming into play, and there was so much stuff that's on the that hadn't been found in the world on the ocean floor that it looked to me like it was going to be a good, solid, proper business. You know, cargo recovery, basically, working with governments and doing it legally and all that sort of stuff. What I found was all these older guys running around with parrots on their shoulders, making really bad decisions, and there's far more money that's been raised to go treasure hunting that's ever been raised off the ocean floor.
Gotcha.
A lot of bullshit, a lot of con men.
I would imagine.
A lot of guys losing their mind, you know. They get a couple of old coins, gold coins or something, and they go to a business meeting and throw them on the table and try and raise money. The guy just picks them up and feels them and looks at them and he's hooked.
Yep.
And next thing you know, he's spending money to become a pirate.
Yeah.
And I found in the middle of it all, and you find a couple of gold bars, and everyone thinks it's theirs. You do all the research, all the work, and or take all the risks. And then you bring it up, and everyone says, that's ours. I said, what do you mean it's yours? You didn't do all the work to go and get it. You didn't spend $300,000-$400,000 to find it. So I did a job, a salvage job, where I recovered a whole bunch of earth-moving equipment, big coal trucks, D8 Cats, big excavators that had rolled off a barge not too far from where we were based in Indonesia. And we went in plain sight, and there was probably several million dollars worth of equipment. And we picked it up and took it to the wharf, unloaded it, put it on the low boys and low loaders, and drove away with it. And no one cared. If it had been one gold bar, it would have been the front page of the paper. And so that was when I sort of lost interest in treasure hunting.
Wave chasing surfer and explorer, best known as the captain of the Indies Trader fleet, described by Surfing Magazine as burly, outspoken, and as impenetrable as the steel hull of his ship, end quote. It is often said that Daly has discovered more high-quality surf breaks than anybody in the world. In 1991, Tom Carroll leaked photos of a trip he took with Daly, and shortly thereafter, the Mentawai Islands became the premier destination for Surf Magazine photo trips, surf brand product shoots. With it, the soon-to-be-booming Sumatra-based surf charter industry was born, with Daly at the fore. In 1999, putting into motion an idea that Daly and former pro surfer Bruce Raymond came up with a few years earlier, Quicksilver hired Daly to captain the Indies Trader for a promo campaign called The Crossing, a worldwide exploration of surf that lasted for 6 years, with the Indies Trader visiting 27 countries and covering 160,000 nautical miles. By that time, Daly's own charter business had 60 employees. Since the mid-90s, Daly has been taken to task for exposing, crowding, and even exploiting the surf breaks he has discovered. We dive into all of those things in today's episode with the man who Surfer Magazine listed as number 18 on their 25 Most Powerful People in Surfing feature in 2002. My name is David Scales for Surf Splendor. I hope that you enjoy my conversation with Martin Daly. We recorded it in the library of the Surfing Heritage and Culture Center, surrounded by a comprehensive archive of surf magazines all the way back through the 60s, many of which feature Martin and many that he hadn't ever seen.
But I just never managed to keep anything.
Oh, I see.
There was so much material that was generated on the Quicksilver when I was associated with them. I was just too busy doing it.
Gotcha.
And I kind of regret it because I haven't got any photographs. I haven't really got any of the magazines. I've got a couple of T-shirts, which my son wears all the time, but
yeah,
they're too small for me now.
Sure.
And, yeah.
I mean, the idea, though, that so much of your life's experience is documented professionally by photography,
yes,
is kind of remarkable.
Well, it really is just the last bit, you know, after sort of the payday.
Oh, okay.
If you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
When I sort of got associated with the surfing industry, but
that's only, you refer to that as the last bit?
Yeah.
Hasn't it been 20 or 30 years at this point? Early 90s,
I guess? You know, time, as you get older, time moves quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're younger, it's the special stuff when you're younger that seems to take the longest time, and then things take a roll on. Right. So it seems like yesterday that I was associated with Quicksilver and doing a crossing and all that stuff, but the stuff that was before that seemed to be a lot more of it.
I see.
It was kind of a blur, you know?
Let's talk about that stuff, because I feel like people in the surf world are familiar with your name. Your name pops up in surf media every once in a while.
Yeah.
But I don't know that everybody's really familiar with your origin story. Let's start with what came first, surfing or sailing for you?
Surfing.
Did it?
I was born in Sydney. And Sydney's got a very similar beach culture, or even more of a beach culture than in Los Angeles. You know, when I was a toddler, I was down the beach, sort of swimming between the flags, and the beach was, you know, everybody was on the beach all summer, and, you know, riding around on small foam boards and then big Bolter longboards, and you know, but the beach was front and center with everybody at that time when I was a kid.
When did sailing come into the picture?
My dad always had a boat of some sort.
Okay.
He used to race sailing boats, you know, like 18-footer fast skiffs, and then we had always had a power boat or a speed boat of some sort, and a couple of hideous trailer sailors, things that go really, really slow and don't really do anything properly.
From the age of 10, Martin began working as a deckhand on a charter boat, taking people fishing and diving around the barrier reefs in northern Queensland.
You know, that was pretty formative because we were going to places that weren't even chartered back in the early 70s. The charts just said, you know, reef report of Flinders 1850 or 1770 or something.
Wow.
But so things have changed a lot.
Yeah.
You know? And just looking back, we had no GPS, no idea where we were going, so we'd just leave port in Townsville, North Queensland, and get a compass heading, and then we'd drive for 5 or 6 or 8 hours, and then we'd get to the top of the mast, make sure it was daytime, and look out and see if we could see a reef anywhere, because there's no islands out there, just the barrier reef. And then we'd see a reef, drive up to it, and we'd hope it was one we were looking for.
From the earliest days, Martin wanted to own a charter boat, but his path to that goal was not short, and it required that he persevere dozens of menial jobs to get there.
The guy that I used to go out, a guy called Cocky Watson, with his boat, the Seacock, had a big rooster on the side of it.
Gotcha.
he promised me a job when I was 15. So I left school to go and work for him,
okay,
thinking I was going to get my captain's ticket and be crew on his boat. And he built building this charter boat down in Newcastle. And then there was some sort of economic crisis in the early 70s, and he lost the boat. And I suddenly found myself at 16 without a job or a career or a future, just no education. I'd skipped school, didn't think I needed it. And sort of bummed around, surfing, doing nothing much, trying to figure out what I was going to do, and did a million crappy jobs. I think 52 I counted before I figured out.
No way.
Every, you know, from cleaning toilets to meat works to labouring, digging ditches, you know, waiting tables, barman, planting pine trees, cutting pine trees, thinning pine trees, working on a sheep farm, or what you call a sheep ranch here, I don't know.
Sure.
And so it wasn't until I actually took up professional diving that I actually figured out what I wanted to do.
What were you doing as a professional diver?
I worked in the oil field in Southeast Asia, doing underwater maintenance, inspection, construction, you know, on the oil rigs, and ended up doing a little bit of saturation diving. And then probably I only actually worked for other people for 3 years, and I started my own company and took one of the major contracts off the big company called Oceaneering that I was working with.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't very popular.
No.
and I ran a commercial diving company for about 10 or 12 years. And the idea was to use that to pay for the boat so I could go look for surf.
Where were you looking at the time?
Well, the first trip we did on the Indies Trader, which is the Raider then, was a friend of mine, Jeff Chitty, and a guy called Dave Wiley. They're both dead, unfortunately, now. The guy Robert Wilson, who started Rip Curl in Indonesia and Asia. We headed out on Dave Barnett's boat, which was called the Raider, which is now the Indies Trader. He rented it to us for $500 a day, and we went looking for surf, and we found one palm and all the waves of Penaitan and up the coast of Sumatra to the bottom of the Mentawais and that area, and that was the first real surf trip that we ever did.
What year was that?
It was about April, May 1983, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It was great.
When was your first surf charter?
Surf charter would have been probably... Well, I bought the boat in October 86.
Okay.
And I took in later on that year, or maybe the next year, I took Nat Young and a couple of his friends from Sydney, and Dave Wiley went out to an island called Engano, which is the south of the Medawise. And that was actually the first time I actually got paid to take anyone. They chartered the boat. And then I gave it a rest for a while, went diving, and got tied up in all sorts of nefarious activities. And really, I think the first charter was probably at 91, when I took Potts and Tom Carroll and Ross Clark Jones and Stuart Cadden out on a trip to the Mentawais.
How did that initial trip happen with Nat Young? Did you know them through the surf world?
Dave Wiley had come from Avoca, which is just north of Sydney, and somehow he knew somebody who knew him.
Okay.
And Dave was he used to live in Sumba. He's sort of the Sumba guy. And he was living in Jakarta at the time, and he somehow conned me into taking these guys out. I was kind of starstruck with Nat.
Yeah, I would imagine.
At that stage, I mean, I was just a recreational surfer, never been a fantastic surfer, but really loved it.
Yeah.
And, I was pretty excited to meet someone of that caliber. And he was very large, a large and a life guy, you know. He wanted us, funnily enough, we went to Engano, and this is in 1986 or 7. And he goes, let's build a surf camp on the beach here. Right? And to this day, there's still nothing here.
Oh, yeah.
And he wanted me to do all this stuff, and he was real fired up on it. And in the end, I just flagged him. I just went, nah.
Why not?
I wasn't really into that. I thought it was kind of exploitive at the time. And I was really keen to do a whole lot more exploration.
Yeah.
Nat was a very type A guy, and I just didn't think it was going to work.
Just the name Indonesia is synonymous with images of empty peeling reef breaks unloading in front of palm-lined beaches. But in the early 80s, very few people had any awareness of just how wave-rich the region was. And even if they did, no one had the resources to explore it.
They didn't have a clue. There was nobody there, and there was nobody looking, and nobody had a boat.
Right.
Right? I went to Nias in 1980. Or 81, I can't remember, I think it was 1980. And the movie Storm Riders had just come out, and it was just on the map, that photograph that Eric Ada had done of Lagundri Bay with the coconuts in the background and the wave peeling, make it look like it was like this long point break, which it's not. And that photograph had captured everyone's imagination. And so I got there, and this hideous road trip to get there, boats and motorbikes and vomiting people all over, you know, Indonesian bus rides, the whole deal. And I got there, and there was 30 guys out. I couldn't believe it.
Holy cow. Tourists.
Surfers. And they were good, hardcore surfers. Everyone just went there. This is, just at that time. And I couldn't even get a wave, to be honest. I stayed there for 6 weeks, got malaria, nearly died.
Oh, my God.
And I just was sleeping on this coral floor with mosquito-infested what do they call those things here? We call them besa blocks, concrete blockhouse.
Okay.
What are you calling them? Cinder blocks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just hideously hot, mosquito, crap food, and crowded. And I'm going to myself at the time, what am I doing here? I could see coast that way and coast that way, and I spoke to people and said, well, it must be surf everywhere. They went, nah, mate, nah, just here. This is all there is. Oh, there's a place out there where there's some islands called the Hinakos where a couple of guys have been, but this is the place, mate. You don't need to go any further. But I was sitting there and going, I've got to get a boat. I can't deal with this.
Yeah.
And there's got to be between here and Sumatra, so here in Java and G-Land, there's got to be waves everywhere. And so I got back from that, went diving again, and I had a couple of diving buddies, a friend called Jeff Jitty and another guy called Ross Hannon. And then we said, I just tried to talk him into buying a boat together. And we looked at a couple of old concrete yachts and stuff. Instead, we went to Bali and rented a place down there and hung out in Bali. There was no one there, so that was still pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
That quickly deteriorated to, you know, we had semi-secret breaks in Bali. There was a place we used to call, you know, we used to whisper about a place called Canggu. We used to whisper about a place called Bingen. You know, these places were sort of on the bucket side, and you'd never see anybody. Yeah. And then they got crowded, and then we left.
Despite Martin's desire to surf and his early dreams of owning a charter boat, he didn't immediately recognize the business opportunity for a surf charter. Or he had consternation about the potential ramifications of a successful surf charter business.
I didn't pursue it. It was one of those things where you just do something and the whole world beats a path to your door. I was really off the whole idea. You know, we were doing it ourselves and we were exploring, and then we had this place that we found, which we called One Palm Point, which is this amazing left-hander. I think it's still, to this day, one of the best lefts in the world.
Really?
And only we knew about it. And one of my mates had told a photographer about it, a guy called Crawford, kneeboarder. And he was an Australian surf photographer, pretty famous guy. And next thing you know, there was the charter boat turned up. This guy called the Surf Travel Company. And we were just blown out. We were so pissed off. It was our own private, you know, we just had it to ourselves and we just felt like it was ours.
Mm-hmm.
And other people turning up was not something we even ever anticipated. There was a period there where, you know, we go down there on Indies Trader or the Raider, which was called then, and just with a couple of friends and go surfing and hang out, and we didn't really understand the surfing world. We weren't really interacting with anybody and just doing our own thing. I used to wear coveralls to surf in.
No way.
Yeah. To keep the sun off you, and also when you rolled around the reef, you can get cut up.
Oh my gosh, that's fascinating.
And the first time I took this trip, I did with sort of going backwards and forwards a bit, but I got Tom Carroll used to give me the hardest time about, like, why are you wearing coveralls? And he made up this story that I used to surf in coveralls and work boots, but
yeah, he didn't have the work boots.
Didn't have the work boots on. And I went back to Penaeton just recently with GoPro, and all the guys are completely covered up, head to toe in rubber, helmets, padding on their backs.
Actual wetsuits?
Yeah.
Really?
Protection from the reef. And, it's a pretty shallow wave.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I wonder if they're wearing 2mm wetsuits?
Yeah, really thin wetsuits, but they've got elbow pads and butt pads. Wow. I mean, if you fall off there, you hit the reef.
Wow.
That's pretty heavy.
Right.
You don't just scrape it, you get driven into it sometimes. So.
Right. Concerned about overexploiting his discoveries, Martin developed a plan to make a living doing dive charters and then reserve the surfing for private exploration. That was until a tragedy redirected his course.
I think it was about 1991 or 90, yeah, sometime around there. I'd already found the Mentawais and already been up there and understood what was going on. So I built this charter boat in Australia called the Volcanic. And that was the first charter boat that was probably in the whole West Sumatra ever. I'd been up there on the Trader One, but the Volcanic, I wanted to do dive charters. The concept was that I'd do scuba diving charters and then sneak out and go for a surf.
Okay.
And not to actually do surf charters. And just getting that going, and then there was a fire. It was a long story, but a couple of people died. The boat was gone. There was a fire in another boat next to mine, and three boats went up. And a couple of... And that was sort of a fork in the road, you know? I was always worried about my friends that were working for me diving, that they were going to get, you know, when the phone calls in the middle of the night were always scary.
Yeah.
Because all my friends are working for me, and diving is quite hazardous. And then when we had this fire and people died, I kind of gave me a bit of a wake up call, and I kind of said, I'm going to get out of this diving business. And I thought about, do I end up in an office with a suit and tie on, or do I end up going surfing for a living?
Hmm.
And because I'd been up there on this volcanic with, this is when I took, one surf trip on that boat was with Potts and Ross and Tom. It wasn't on the Indies Trader.
Okay.
It was on this beautiful charter boat I built called the Volcanic. And after that, I mean, it was just like an avalanche of people trying to get to the Mentawais with me.
Was that trip documented and published in surf media? Okay, no, but no, they just no got back there was and no spread
professional
the word.
There was no professional photographers on board. It was just a boys' trip. I got conned into it. I had no idea that they were coming. And if I'd have known that they were coming, I wouldn't have taken them.
Why not?
Well, we were trying to keep it to ourselves. We're being selfish, I guess.
Hmm.
I'd heard of Tom Carroll, but I never heard of Ross, and I never heard of Potts. We didn't really get surf magazines or anything in those days. So what happened is I had a friend in Bali, in the oil field, they knew, and whenever those guys came to Bali, he had a big house in Legian, and they would stay with him. So I guess they were, you know, having a few beers and talking about it, and I told my friend that I was going up there surfing, the surf was awesome. And he said, oh, how about I charter your boat? And I said, and it was the right time of year, like it was coming on, it was like March, ready at the beginning of the season, and I really wanted to get back up there. And he says, oh, I got a few friends from Bali. I said, well, they kept their mouth shut. And he said, oh, yeah, they'll keep their mouth shut. They're local guys, you know. And I said, all right, Paul, well, that's cool. We'll just split the cost, you know. I don't know, can we come up with like $1,400 or something for fuel and everything else? He goes, yeah. So I kept on saying, Paul, can I have the crew list? I need it for the Harbour Master. And he goes, yeah, I'll get it to you. Paul, I need some money, you know, to buy the fuel and everything. So he sent money. And then where's the crew list? And it's like 2 days or 3 days before the trip. And it was Martin Potter, Ross Clark Jones, Tom Carroll, all these pro surfer guys. And I was incensed. And so I sort of snapped at him. I said, what are you doing, mate? You know that these guys will just blow it out. He goes, oh, they're really good guys. They won't say a word. I said, yeah, right. So I said, well, we can find someone else to take us, Martin, if you like. And I said, well, I was torn. A, I was like, Tom Carroll was my idol. And B, I wanted to get up there. It was the right time of the year. I was frothing to get to go surfing. And I was going to pay the bills. And so I just sort of went, at least I'll have 2 weeks to talk him into not telling anyone.
Right.
Right? And we had an amazing trip. Some of the best surf I've ever seen in the Mentawais to this day.
Wow.
We went to, we surfed a left-hander we call laxatives. Still to this day, some of the biggest paddling waves ever in Indonesia, including like some of these photographs you see of Outside Corner. I've got the photographs somewhere. It's huge.
Hmm.
And we pulled up to this place and Ross and Tom and Potts and all the guys jumped out. And one set came through and everybody else came back in. It looked like it was about 6 foot, maybe 8 foot. And the first set came through and Tom was calling it 18 feet Hawaiian.
Holy cow.
And they just played with it. And I had never seen pro surfers before. I mean, I've seen Nat and he's a good surfer, but these guys were at their prime. Tom had just had done the snap that had gone around the world or whatever. And they were kind of maniacs. So they were out there in these waves and it was like they were doing crossovers. Like they were paddling in together and yeah.
Unreal.
That was Tom and Ross. They're kind of nuts, those guys. Ross got caught inside and lost his, wearing helmets, lost his helmets, lost his board shorts. Two wave hold down. He said at the time it was the worst wipeout he'd ever had.
Wow.
And just went to pick him up in the tin boat, and he just went, take us back out.
Wow. He's a maniac.
I think he likes it.
Yeah.
I think he seeks that.
Yeah.
And Yes, and then I realized the difference between the regular Joe that surfs and these guys. I mean, they were on shortboards, paddling into these monstrous, perfect waves. And then we went out to the Mentawais and we surfed further up, and we surfed at telescopes, and it was still the best I've ever seen it. Ross and Stuart Cadden were both, I think, goofy footers. No, sorry, Tom and Stuart Cadden. And they'll take off on a peak way up the line at telescopes that I've never seen anyone surf since.
Interesting.
It was like 18 wave sets.
Crazy.
It was amazing that day.
Yeah.
And we just pulled up at dawn. I'd surfed the wave before crappy, and I was just sort of coming up. We pulled up, and it was 8 feet, and just the sunlight coming up, mist, and these waves. And I remember the guys coming up, bumping their heads, walking out the door, just going, "What?"
Yeah.
I said, "How long has this been going on?"
And, wild.
Yeah.
And they obviously did not keep the secret.
Well, you know, they didn't know where they were going. The charts were all hidden and everything else, and you know, but. Tom took some video, and Tom's a bit of a, you know, keen photographer, and he actually typed in the bottom of it where it was.
Oh, okay.
Text. And then, of course, he's on the pro tour, so the next place he goes to is the pro tour with all the photographers, and the whole surfing world's there, you know. And then that's the hardest people to deal with, is the pro photographers. They're the guys that usually talk the most about surf spots.
Right.
And with a few exceptions. And of course, you know, Tom's showing his videos to everybody a week later in California or something. And they got back to me pretty quickly. So there's so much for that.
Yeah.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. And there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah. Or they said, if you don't take us, we'll find somebody else to do it. Was there anybody else to do it?
No.
So, yeah. So when that influx of tourism happens, it all has to funnel through you, basically.
Initially, yeah. Okay. I mean, we were it. And it's a long story. I mean, it's such an interesting story of betrayal, would be the word.
Who betrayed who?
Everybody betrayed everybody. From the beginning to today, you know.
Really? Yeah. Just because it's a finite resource and everybody wants to get there.
Yeah, well, it's just, I mean, it's a resource, I guess, like a gold rush, I guess. I mean, you know, we were sort of the holder, we had the keys for a long time. And then other people, anyone, it seemed like anyone I met or anyone that came close to it ended up competing with us.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a bold claim. It's a story of betrayal.
Yeah.
So who do you feel betrayed by?
Everybody that's ever worked for me.
Really?
Just about, yeah. Just so like if you were to do a roll call in the Mentawais of the charter boats, you would find a connection to me in some way on probably most of the older boats, at least. You know, ex-skippers, ex-cooks, ex-employees.
Yeah. You did the same thing in your diving company, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So it comes full circle.
Yeah, but that was a publicly listed corporate company.
Is there a graceful way to do it? I mean,
I understand it. I mean, I'm not bitter and twisted about it.
Yeah.
I had to accept it, otherwise I'd be a bitter and twisted old idiot. And I've just come back from there, last week, and it was fantastic. It's just the same as ever was.
Yeah.
But I was in an anchorage looking at all my ex-employees' boats. There was about five of them floating, all painted the same color.
Really?
So, yeah.
I mean, despite that, you still built a significant business. I think I was reading somewhere you had 60 employees at one time running how many different boats?
Well, at the peak of it, I guess it was the late 90s, early 2000, about then. I had the Indies Trader, which was on the crossing, but when I got back, the Indies Trader 2, the Indies Trader 3, the Indies Trader 4, and the Adventure Komodo. So it was quite a fleet. And I had an island and workshop facilities, and it was turning into quite an industrial deal. And I don't know why, I just decided that it was just too much. And I think I just kind of got carried away. And so I started winding things back about 2010.
Well, I'm curious about, I'm always interested in like the businesses behind surfing. Number one, you're doing it in Indonesia, which has to just be fraught with all sorts of peril. From a red tape kind of standpoint and bureaucracy. No,
but I was really lucky because I had a mentor, a guy called Dave Barnett, who I used to work on the Indies Trader. He's the guy that built it.
Okay.
Just saw him the other day, came around the house. He's still around, lives down the road from me in Perth. And he's an incredibly intelligent man. And he'd been living in Indonesia for 12 years, I think, when I met him. And he was really savvy and really understood Indonesia, how it worked, an incredibly smart guy. So I was lucky. He passed me on all his intellectual property when I bought the boat off him. Staff, attitude, how to do things. How to pay people off, but not get involved in corruption. In other words, how to get through life on the what we call one rokok, which is cigarette money, as opposed to paying bribes to circumvent the course of business. One's a tip to get service, and the other one's in Indonesia. That's the kind of the ethic. We understand that everyone must pay for everything.
It's a fine line, though.
But it is a fine line, and a lot of expatriates that come to Indonesia cross that line in a kind of confusing way.
Yeah.
And a lot of it going on in the Mentawais right now. People trying to figure out how to build resorts and getting fleeced by everybody. And
you were pioneering what you were doing. So I would imagine easy to cross that line the wrong way.
Nobody else was doing it, and no one knew why we were doing it. And they couldn't figure it out. Why are these guys so keen about playing in the surf?
Yeah,
I mean, for Indonesians, it wasn't a serious enterprise. We were just playing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems frivolous.
Totally.
So were you employing then local people when you were at that level?
Yeah, always. So I've still got the crew that I inherited.
Do you?
I've got two guys, Kasman and Samanto, who were on the boat when I bought it off Dave in 1986. And they're both the same age as me. They're in their 60s.
Wow.
So they've been working for me since 86. I've been on the boat before that, so that's a long time.
Yeah. Mm.
And they were kids.
Were they?
Yeah.
I'm curious if you feel, I mean, you talk about feeling a little bit of consternation about exploiting those spots, and it certainly grew outside of your control at a certain
very
point.
Quickly. I have no responsibility for anything that happened there after about 1995 or 6.
In hindsight, is there any way you could have navigated it differently?
No. It's so good. The whole world was going to turn up regardless of what I did. But I think that my legacy, if there is anything there, is the Mentawais is still busy, still fantastic, but it's still a nice place to go surfing.
Can you still find empty surf?
All the time. I think we surfed with other people twice in the last trip. You know, we're not surfing at Lance's Rights or Macaroni's or Telescopes or anywhere in the playground area because there's people everywhere. But if you're prepared to surf B grade or B plus waves, you'll get them by yourself pretty, yeah.
So there aren't better waves.
There's still a couple of, yeah, I don't want to talk too much about it really. There's still a couple of little gems left, but yeah, they're no longer a secret, but at least they're not too busy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the time when you have that many, at the peak of all your employees and boats, were you living at sea full time essentially?
Pretty well, yeah. I mean, we had a place in Padang and they had the island just off Padang. We rented an island there and we had a base and a wharf and workshop, and it was pretty cool. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time on the water, more time than I do now.
How old were you at that time?
40s.
What did family life look like for you?
Well, my wife is sitting right here. You can ask her if you like.
How long have you guys been married?
21 years.
Was she spending time with you on the boat?
It's hilarious. When I first met her, she was like, oh, yeah, I'll cook. Yeah, I'll be on the boat, right? And then we got married, and probably that was the last time she actually was on the boat.
Did you have kids?
Yeah, I got 2 kids, yeah.
I mean, because without knowing any of this information prior to asking you, I would think that you would have to choose one or the other.
Yeah, it's funny, huh? It's worked out pretty well.
How did it work logistically?
Well, basically, I go home whenever I can, and the kids and the family come to the boat, hang out with me whenever they can. Not ideal, but then, you know, they used to live in Jakarta.
Okay.
And in 2003, we moved to Perth, or moved the family down there. And, you know, they got a nice Australian upbringing, and I come home and I'm hanging out with everybody. I'm not really working that much.
Good.
And Lee developed her own life, and I developed my own life, and then we sort of cross paths all the time. But now that we've the kids are just about ready to leave home, it's interesting.
What career path do they want to pursue?
My daughter's very academic. She wants to be a geneticist, so she's in the middle of, she's a postgraduate, what they call honours in Australia, before she goes to the PhD level or whatever. She graduated for her first degree this year. And my son doesn't know what he wants to do.
Okay.
I think he's more interested in chasing girls right now than anything else.
Fair enough. But they don't want to get into the charter business.
I think my son would like to.
But he's preoccupied at the moment.
He's just 18.
Come on. Do you have any regrets about time spent away from them? Would you have done that differently?
Look, I've got a friend called John McGroder, my ex-skipper. He married the girl who used to work with me at Quicksilver, and he's brought his kids up on the boat. You know, like you know, sort of the whole, they've stayed on the boat, the kids have grown up on the boat, and so he kind of did the alternative. And I don't know if you ask Belinda, his wife, or Lee, which had the best existence. I think Lee kind of ended up with a better deal.
Really?
Yeah. She's an amazing woman, Belinda.
Yeah.
McGroder.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the lifestyle is not for everybody. I mean, it sounds...
Can you imagine bringing a bunch of kids with eight or ten drunken surfers on board the boat all the time?
That are always coming and going and transient.
And always expecting to party. And
you know, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fair enough. They want to go on a boys' boat trip. That's what they expect, and they should get it, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And that's just part of it, though. But living at sea is an entirely different thing that's not everybody's cut out for.
Cramped conditions on a boat, hiding in the back cabin.
Yeah.
From everybody. It's not for everybody at all.
No.
Yeah. I really think she's done... It's amazing what they've achieved.
Good. I'm curious what the best surfing you've ever witnessed is.
Kelly Slater.
Really?
Always.
No question.
It didn't take me long to think of it.
No, it didn't.
Yeah.
When and where?
Well, Kelly's been coming on the boat. I probably spent over a year in his company in total. I think the first time was 93. He was 21, and I see him every year pretty well. He comes in the boat. Now he's coming to the place in the Pacific. And actually, he was out there with John Florence last year, I think. And it was the first time I've ever seen anyone out surf Kelly.
Wow.
Free surfing.
Yeah.
So I sort of went, wow, this guy actually is like, he's winning the heat with Kelly. And that was the first time I'd ever seen it.
Was that documented?
Yeah. I think it was called Taylor's Proximity.
Yeah. I've seen that footage. So Kelly's not the best surfing you've ever witnessed then?
Well, that was only one session. There's a bit of an age difference.
And Kelly's not at his prime anymore.
Well, I think he is. I was at Mark River watching him surf last week and stunning.
It's funny how you were talking about that initial trip with Ross Clark Jones and Potts and Tom Carroll,
mm-hmm.
and how much better they were than everybody else that you had witnessed surf before. Yeah. I've had that experience certainly in Southern California. Every pro surfer comes through mm-hmm. in the course of a year. And they're mind-blowingly better than what you've witnessed. But then Kelly Slater shows up every once in a while, or John,
mm-hmm.
and they are that much better than those other pros that you've seen.
Yes.
And like the degrees of difference are unbelievable. Like you didn't know that they could be that attuned to the ocean.
There's a few guys that I've seen that have that sort of extra.
Yeah.
The set waves always seem to come to them.
Right.
Exactly. They got that magic, you know. Josh Kerr is one of those guys.
Really?
They really, really impressed me years ago. We go out surfing and you just get every set wave and just get barreled, and no one is even getting anywhere near a barrel, and all of a sudden Josh is getting barreled, you know.
Yep.
Tom Curran, of course.
Totally.
Yeah.
Tom's probably the best
example. They've got that sort of extra cosmic crap going on or whatever.
Yeah, it is. It really, it's like an attunement with the ocean.
Yeah.
I'm curious why you left the Mentawise.
I haven't left.
Oh, you haven't?
Yeah, I'm still there.
Just running charters now, or?
Oh, yeah. No, I just got back a week ago.
Okay.
Yeah. I've still got the Indies Trader 3 out there, which is the best. So basically, I got rid of all the other charter boats and kept the best one.
Gotcha.
I just figured, why? But I can only go surfing on one boat. Why have I got five?
Right.
And so that's kind of, we just sneak around and do our thing and try and pretend there's no one else there.
Tell me about your investment in Barron Island Resort and the project there.
So I knew what was happening in the Mentawise.
Meaning?
What was going to happen. The writing was on the wall in the 90s. I saw it and I went, so now what am I going to do? You know, because I've been so lucky throughout my life. I've never surfed in crowded surf. And I don't know how to surf when there's crowds. I don't know how to hustle for waves. I just go out there and expect to get every set wave. And so with the crossing, the Quicksilver Crossing came along. And I pitched that in 94 when no one even knew about the Mentawise to go and have a look at look for more places.
And pitched what exactly?
I pitched the idea to Rip Curl and Quicksilver consecutively at Quicksilver's house at Sunset Beach in Hawaii.
Pitch the idea of the crossing or pitch the idea of the resort?
No, the crossing.
Gotcha.
And so Quicksilver paid me to drive around the world, and I told them I'm going to do it at that meeting. They laughed me out of the room, and to do a global survey where the next place was. And so I spent 7 years on, sponsored by Quicksilver, going to every single tropical nation on Earth. And in the end, we didn't go there to the Marshall Islands. They wouldn't go there because it was too far out of the way or whatever. And when I finally got there, It was the next best thing to Indo.
You had been waiting to go there for that long, for 7 years?
When I first got the charts out with Bruce Raymond for the Quicksilver in Sydney. We bought all these charts over the whole world. Like, I spent about $8,000 on charts because there's no Google Earth. There was nothing like that. It was just paper charts. And I remember going to this place where we were at in the Marshalls and putting a cross on the map, which is in a surf break, which we now call Nirvana, right? And I went to Bruce, we've got to go there. Look at the way the reef turns. Look at the wind direction. Look at it all. That's got to be the spot. And that's hilarious because he wouldn't go there. We couldn't go there because of, you know, corporate promotional deals we had to do and everything else. And finally, that ended up being the best place that I'd ever.
Amazing.
Yeah. No Google Earth. It was just looking at the chart.
Right. Yeah. So you identified that as a potential prop for the Quicksilver crossing and then never made it.
Never made it there.
And then once the crossing wrapped up, you decided to go.
Well, we were coming home from here. We went, you know, the crossing ended here. When Quicksilver bought Rossignol and the whole beginning of the end, sort of that process. And went to Hawaii to try and resurrect the crossing. And we went there for the eddy opening and all that sort of stuff. And it fell apart. So I sent the boat back to Indonesia. And if you draw a line from Hawaii to Indonesia, you've got to go drive through the Marshall Islands.
Gotcha.
And we got there on Christmas Day, or Christmas Eve, I think. And on Christmas Day, or was it New Year's Day, it was 8 feet, 8 to 10 feet, perfect. And went, okay. And I flew. I didn't go on the boat. I flew home, met the boys over there, and then we spent 6 months driving around there looking for surf.
Wow.
With Rip Curl, funny enough. It was great. I was pretty stoked with the whole thing.
Validated.
And then went backwards and forwards to Indonesia a few times. I brought the Indies trader back to the Marshall Islands.
Okay.
Bought the big boat, the Trader 4, up there for a couple of seasons and did charters there and seeing what it was like. And then we had the economic crisis in, was it 2009?
Yeah, 8, 9.
Yeah, and everybody got scared. I didn't want to spend the money on fuel to drive all the way up to the, 7,000 miles, whatever it is, from Padang to the Marshalls. And so I didn't go, and I thought it was over, my relationship with the Marshall Islands. And it's just looking at the things were happening in Indo and that and everything else. They kept on bugging me that I wanted to get back there. And some other stuff happened with the bureaucracy. I had to get the Indies trader out of the country and whatever, you know. And I just said, that's the future for me. And I sailed in there with two boats, the Indies trader and another boat called the Windward. And then we just said, that's where I want to go. I want to lease this island. That's it. That's my end play.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Well, what is the end play? What was the concept? It's a resort.
It's a resort. It's just like I built this beautiful big house that you'd see at Malibu or somewhere. On a deserted island. There's no one around. It's private. The waves are really good. Not as consistent as the Mentawai's, but still really, really good. But the other thing I like about it is the isolation, because the world's shrinking so quickly. The fact that all the reefs are alive, or there's fish in the ocean, it's untouched. And so I'm trying my very best not to do as little damage as possible.
Okay.
And I've been playing around with solar energy and wind power and sort of all those sort of green initiatives. And we're getting pretty close to being able to say we've got an actual eco resort.
So it lives entirely off the grid, essentially.
Yeah, well, I couldn't have built it if I didn't have a boat. The Indies Trader is a cargo ship, so we used the Indies Trader to run backwards and forwards with all the supplies and stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we're completely independent. We grow our own food, we go fishing, we've got solar power, we've got wind power, we've got solar hot water systems, but we got internet, we sit there watching Netflix. It's kind of bizarre.
Wow.
You're lying in a beautiful house in the middle of nowhere watching Netflix on an 80-inch screen. Looking out there at the wind, the surf peeling down the point next to you, it's kind of surreal. You go, and then your air-conditioned rooms, and it's just around the corner. And
the staff has living quarters on the island.
Yeah,
as well?
Yeah. Well, okay. It's a really big building. So there's an office downstairs where a couple air-conditioned office where a couple of the guys stay.
Okay.
And then with the boats are at the wharf, and the guys stay on the boats, look after the boats, and then there's a bit of accommodation here and there. So yeah, most people that go there just. They see the photographs and everything else, and they say, yeah, whatever. And they walk in there, and you can see their faces. They've just been on this arduous trip to get there, and they're getting a bit grumpy. Some of the richer guys, too, you know, like they're not quite as five-star as they'd like. And then they walk in there, and, you know, the frowns on their face, and they walk out, and they just go, no way. And they just, everything lifts. And yeah.
What's the surf like? And are there options like walkable out front, or do you boat everywhere?
We have some waves out the front. We have some really nice waves. They need Kona winds.
Okay.
It's generally onshore, the wave at the front, but when it's on, it's insane.
Yeah.
There's a couple of other waves on the other side of the island that, you know, recreational sort of waves where people go out and stand up paddleboard or you know. And then generally it's a boat trip, a tin boat ride or 2 or 3 miles.
Gotcha.
To a couple of breaks, so they're pretty good.
Do you follow any surf media?
Well, John over here is my media guy, and he's put us on Instagram and trying to bring us up to date with all that sort of stuff.
Why do you feel a need for a media guy?
I guess it's just the time we're in. You've got to keep current. I mean, mm-hmm. We've got to have the resort and the Marshalls. We've got to book it. And we've got to interact with people, and you set up a credit card and booking platforms. And you know, people ask a lot of questions, and a good website helps reduce the number of questions you get asked. My wife fields a lot of the inquiries. And if you imagine you've got 30 people going on a holiday or 20 people going on a holiday, you imagine how many questions that you've got to answer.
Yep.
And you've got to do it with good faith and good spirit, and so the more information they get, they can access online, the better.
Yeah. Just reduces the workload.
Yeah.
So in terms of surf media, I mean, you've been so influential for so much of surf media for so long. What do you yourself read and look for and enjoy?
That's an interesting question. Surfers Journal, pretty well, would be the only thing I probably sit down and read cover to cover. You know, I mean, I quite enjoy some of the sort of irreverent, what's Chad Smith's one?
Beach Grit.
Beach Grit, yeah.
Yeah, you like it?
I quite enjoy that, yeah.
He's currently sailing down to Cabo.
Oh, yeah?
Left today, yeah.
Okay.
There's
a few of those, sort of Stab.
Yeah.
They're quite entertaining.
Yeah.
Very, very irreverent, which I kind of enjoy.
Totally. Yeah. Surfing is irreverent.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Obviously you have a bunch of logistical constraints with your various businesses, but I'm curious where you would like to explore. Given no constraint, where would you go see?
Well, I started exploring the Pacific Ocean in 1995, I guess. And I wanted to do every square inch of the Indonesian coastline. And I have.
Have you really?
Yeah. I bought every square inch that faces a swell, north and south and all that sort of stuff. And so with the, you know, I mean, I really, probably the most, I'm a bit of an exploration junkie. For me to go somewhere where I've never been before and see what's around the next bay, is probably my most fun I can have.
Yeah.
But I've pretty well crossed off just about everywhere in the Pacific now. There's a couple of little places. Google Earth kind of spoils it a bit. You know, you can sort of, and I think Google is responsible for less exploration than more.
Interesting, because you satiate the urge just by looking it up online.
Well, everyone seems to think they can run their universes from their phones, and there's a lot of couch surfing going on.
Yeah.
And you know, back in the day, we would in the wilds of Indonesia, every now and then we'd see a term which we kind of invented on the boat, a feral surfer.
Mm-hmm.
It was a term that was used in New Zealand to describe people that lived off the radar.
Yeah.
And ferals, right?
Yeah.
And a Kiwi captain, and he goes, "Hey, there's a feral on the beach."
And yeah. Rip Curl co-opted it for a film title.
Feral Kingdom. Sunny, yeah. Yeah. But we used to get these guys, and there'd be guys camped in tents in the middle of nowhere, you know, before Timmy Turner showed everyone how to be a really bad camper. There were these guys that were out there, really hardcore purists that were chopping their way through the jungle looking for surf.
Yeah.
And since the internet and since Google Earth, I haven't come across one since.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
You would think there'd be way more.
That is, you know, I spent so much time in unexplored areas over the years, and there's no one out there.
Yeah.
And it seems to be these days, when anyone does go out there, it's on Instagram.
That's the reason why they're going, is just to get the Instagram shot.
Yeah.
So where would you go?
I've done a lot, and to places I go back to, there's one place that I call El Dorado. I'm not going to say where it is. There's only a few places left. That it has like five world-class waves that you can see from one place. Like left, right, right, left, right.
Mm.
All firing. And every one of them is like an A-grade wave, but I've never seen anything like it. It makes the playgrounds in the Mentawai's look restricted.
Have you ever seen anybody else there?
No one's ever been there.
Amazing.
Mm. And I went back there just recently and got kicked out.
By whom?
By the island, by the people.
Really?
Yep. We drove all this way to go there. The swell was coming, and the first time I went there, it was really cool, but kind of weird. And this time, the village, the community was having some issues, some political issues amongst themselves. And then we went to this sort of, you know, tribal meeting hut to get asked permission and everything else. And they were muttering around. They said, "No, you must leave now."
How does that work? I mean, if you just anchored out to sea, would they come out and address it with you?
Oh, they did.
Okay. And they say, come on to land. And
well, we drove past, talked to them on the radio, and we'd been there before and met everybody.
Gotcha.
And didn't think it was going to be an issue. And we were, you know, legally we were fine. But when the locals don't want you there.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh man, we just had a couple of waves. It was like forbidden fruit. And the swell was coming. You know, we've got internet in the boat now. We can understand when the waves are coming.
Yeah.
And we're arguing. I was wondering if the guy, and they said, "It's going to cost you $500 fee." I was like, "Oh, okay, we can
solve that." Yeah.
Right. So I got my money out and gave it to them, and you still got to go. They were having an internal dispute on the island. Someone had been there and they'd found a whole bunch of ingots that were ballast, which is pig iron. And they all thought it was gold or platinum or something. And there was this big, huge fight going on in the island about this supposed treasure. And they figured that we'd come out with my boat called the Indie Surveyor, had all the diving gear on it for our bikini diving program. And they didn't believe that we were just there to go surfing. They thought we had another ulterior motive.
Yeah.
That we were sort of treasure hunting or something.
That makes sense.
And so we got run off.
Yeah.
And then we were panicking because this was a trip. I didn't have any guests on board. It was just me on my own dime looking because I just want to go back there. I was just gutted. And then I said, "Okay, where are we going to go? We're a long way from anywhere." I said, "How about this bit of coast over here? I think we can get there by if we leave now by the morning." And so at the middle of this discussion, I just went, we're not going to win here. Let's go. And we sort of stopped talking, turned around, walked out of the room, walked to the boat, and then the next morning woke up and it was absolutely pumping.
Oh, no.
Somewhere that we'd never been before, and it was firing. So everything's meant to happen.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
When have you ever felt the most in danger?
Towards the end of the crossing with Quicksilver, my contract for the was coming up in November. In June, they'd asked me to extend for another 5 years, and I said I couldn't do it. I'd only do two more years. And then Bob McKnight said, you know, look, do you reckon you can get to Hawaii for the Eddie? And I went, man, it's November. It's the North Pacific in the middle of winter. And to go from San Francisco to Hawaii, that's the biggest stretch of ocean in the world. If you go around the world in a boat, there's this one big piece of ocean, which is the Pacific to Hawaii, or the Pacific to Marquesas. It's just this, there's no island hopping. It's just this one 2,300 nautical mile chunk of ocean you've got to cross. And Bob said, if you can get the boat to Hawaii before the eddy, I think I can salvage everything. And I went, okay. I mean, the Indies Trade, is a trawler hull that's designed to go up and down the coast of Queensland. It wasn't supposed to be a boat that drives around the world. So this was the biggest crossing that we'd ever attempted. And I waited till we had a really good forecast, and we left through the under the Golden Gate, and off we went, you know, calm, and, you know, it was cold and the water was grey, and, you know, and then we headed out. Pretty uneventful for the first week. And there's a weather pattern that sits a bit further south, where there's usually a high and the weather's usually pretty good. But I made a bad decision based on our original track. I did the straight line because I wanted to get there as fast as I could. And I went too far north. I should have gone south and up to Hawaii. And so about day eight, we got involved in a proper Northern Pacific winter storm on the Indies Trader. And the boat was stronger than us. I mean, it was blowing about 35 knots southwest. Southwest, yeah. So that we were going this way, it was coming, and there's this huge chop. Then there was like this 20-foot short period swell, and it looked like we were caught inside in big surf. It was just the tops were blowing off the waves, and then there were these huge wind chop coming up this swell, and they're creating these big holes in the ocean. And every now and then, the boat would fall through the air into one of these holes with the swell pushing it forwards and this big chop coming up it. And the bell would ring. And the boat would just go get air. The propeller would start spinning.
Wow.
And it would go bang. The whole thing would sound like it was going to break in half. And that happened for 2 days.
Oh, my gosh.
We were terrified. The boat was on autopilot, and the boat just chugged through it.
Unbelievable.
You couldn't walk. You couldn't stand up on the boat. You had to crawl around on your hands and knees and grab stuff, and the boat just shook it off like a dog shaking water off it. And then kind of got through that, and then the water started turning blue, and then it calmed down, and then the water getting warmer, and eventually we sailed in to Hawaii. And we were heading for Haleiwa Boat Harbour, and this was huge swell. It was, you know, just before, it was like November the 20-something, and the Haleiwa Boat Harbour was closed.
I mean, because it was so big?
It was too big, right? And we were supposed to then, we were so disappointed. So we drove past the North Shore. Someone saw us go past the big hotel there. What's it, the Turtle Bay? And they kind of woke up and sort of saw the Indies Trader out there. They went, what? We didn't tell anybody we were coming, right? And I said our stuff, I'm going in. So it was a great way to arrive. So a few of the boys had turned up at the dock, and the harbour closes out at the back with a big swell. And so I just did like I normally do in a small boat. I waited, did donuts out the back, and waited till there was a really big set, and then followed it in. And we came surfing in with waves breaking, white water each side of us, the channel. Came surfing in, it was a great way to arrive in Hawaii. And then everything fell apart and the thing was over.
Right. Nothing,
yeah.
But kiss the ground, I'm sure, yeah. Right when you get there.
Oh, we were stoked. I mean, yeah. it was the real thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
It's insane. I'm curious if you've ever traveled inland.
I'm terrible at that. Like, you know, just go to the coast.
I mean, barely the coast. You spend most of your time off the coast.
In the mental ways, I never go to the beach. I'm terrible.
I just think, certainly here, from where we're sitting now, there's such spectacular national parks within one day's driving distance. No interest in that. The Grand Canyon, Zion.
My wife is looking at me.
I know. She looks thrilled.
She wants me to do something that's not related to surfing.
Yosemite, you could get there in 5 hours. No interest.
I'm not particularly interested, but I'll be a good husband and maybe consider doing something like that.
Good man. Yeah. You've gotten to see everything that you want to see. You've gotten to see a lot of what.
Very lucky. Yeah.
The final question for everybody interviewed is just, what was the last surfboard that you rode?
It was a 8-foot Tuflite M13. I've been riding that board for 6 or 7 years.
Really?
Longer. I had a 7.6. Now I'm getting older. I've just added 6 inches, and now I'm riding that's all I ever ride, pretty well.
I saw a photo. It might have been on Matt Warshaw's Encyclopedia of Surfing, and I think it was a Tuflite that you were riding too, but Channel Islands.
Yeah, Channel Islands M13.
Is that your go-to?
I've just had three of them. Yeah, I just don't see any reason. I get on another board, doesn't go as well. I go back to that.
I mean, if that M13's lasted you,
I've had about 20 of them.
Oh, okay.
I keep on snapping them and
gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
And I don't make them anymore. So if anyone's got one, I'd love to buy it off them.
There you go. You might get an email.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, no worries.
IndiesTrader.com is Martin's website. You can also access info for his Marshall Islands resort there as well. And if all of those early days of exploration sounded thrilling to you, they're actually introducing an exploratory trip option very soon as well. So you can actually be a part of pioneering perhaps the next great surf discovery. Of course, you will be sworn to secrecy. I've got photos of Martin and some surf footage of those old, early Quicksilver Crossing days and some other important surf trips that Martin participated in and captained, all on SurfSplendorPodcast.com, along with a comment section. Every past episode of Surf Splendor and the 5 other shows that we produce, all available for free. There's a donation PayPal button if you'd care to support this work. Thank you to those who keep us in business with a monthly recurring option. That is hugely appreciated. I'll be back next week with another installation of our Temples of Stoke series featuring iconic California surf shops. That's presented by the Surfing Heritage and Culture Center. Their Temples of Stoke exhibit opens on Friday, August 9th. You can get tickets and learn more at shack.org. That's shacc.org. In closing, Martin Daly said that Kelly Slater has done the best surfing that he's ever seen. So I'm going to close out with Martin recounting the single best session of Kelly's that he's ever witnessed. Enjoy.
We came around the point at Lance's Rights, Cardiac Village and the Mentawais, in the sort of early 90s. And it was a rain squall. And there was a really stiff offshore blowing into the wave. And the way it was the most perfect I've ever seen Lance's Rights. He paddled out there. It was kind of the the photographers weren't stoked because it was overcast and raining and everything else. I don't think it was actually recorded. And kind of 6 foot. And I've never seen anyone get so barreled for so long.
Really?
He's just basically playing with it, taking off as deep as you possibly could, and disappearing for the whole wave and coming out time and time again. It was the most perfect surf I've ever seen.